Greetings, friends. This is Dr. Mark Sharona, and I want to welcome you to The Edge podcast, where all things theological, psychological, spiritual, and cultural will be explored so that you and I might understand the times and know what to do about them. Enjoy. Friends, I'm delighted today to have with me Dr. Esau McCauley, who is on staff at Wheaton College. He is an Anglican priest. He has been a pastor. He is a brilliant New Testament scholar, a black theologian, someone that has a voice of authority, someone that has a voice of wisdom, someone that has a journey and a story to tell. And I'm just delighted that he's chosen to spend today with us. And I'm looking forward to us opening up what is part of his newest release, Reading While Black. Esau, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
So Esau, when you think about your journey,
yeah,
from a Baptist beginning,
yeah,
probably in those days exposed to some great Baptist preachers.
Yes.
You don't hesitate to talk at all in the book about both the progressive and the conservative aspects of theology from a perspective of liberation. Now, I would love for you to unpack that so that the folk that are listening can hear you talk about that.
Yeah, I think the best thing to there's a book called Lincoln called The Black Church and the African American Experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really understand. Well, let me go back. So when you look at like kind of white Christianity, it moves from the spectrum of left to right, and politically and theologically, there's a large amount of correlation. Of course, it's more complicated than that. That's kind of the spectrum of people understanding from the mainland tradition to the evangelical tradition. In the African-American context, that the lines aren't written and divided in the same way. I would say that like in the African-American Christian tradition, there is a form of black radicalism that is largely kind of deconstructive and reconstructive in its theological approach, that it locates the problem much more in the scriptures themselves than in their interpretation. They see the scripture as being valuable in a lot of ways, especially the testimonies of things like the Exodus narrative and God's preferential option towards the poor. And in that sense, they capture the heart, they capture an important part of the Christian witness. There's also another tradition that, although I would say sees some of the same problems with the biblical text, I don't think anybody's like wishing away and saying there are no difficult like passages in the Bible, but I do think there's much more of an attitude of a hermeneutic of trust.
And yeah, you use that phrase, the hermeneutics of trust. It's a brilliant phrase.
And so that tradition, and this is the part that gets more complicated, that tradition also has a lot of things to say about liberation. It also has a lot of things to say about God's concern for the poor. But it also has a strong emphasis on the holiness of life, and like the importance of personal salvation and who Jesus is in the life of the Christian community. The third community, it's actually four. It's funny. If I were to write the book again, I'd put a fourth category. But I'll talk about what I said in the book. The third category is what you call like what I call black accommodationalist, where their basic posture is they're adopting the talking point and the perspective of the majority culture. So they're basically not challenging the status quo. They want to talk about personal salvation and then kind of look into the by and by. And what I was trying to say in the book is that a lot of times in the public conversation, when you look at black Christianity, it's the black radical tradition arguing with the black accommodationist tradition. And there's this whole huge middle that doesn't get taken seriously or doesn't get listened to. So what I'm saying is it's possible, and this is what I try to show in the book, it's possible to acknowledge the difficult parts of scripture. Is it possible to still to come to some form of trust in those texts as God's word for us for our good, to talk about the importance of like things like personal salvation and contend for justice? And I would say that those four things, right, are part of the mainstream of the African-American Christian tradition. So if you just kind of throw your rock and hit a black church, I would say that would be the ethos that you see coming out of those communities. If I were to write the book again, there's actually a fourth group that I would actually talk about who I didn't mention in the book. And that would be like the black pietist tradition, even partially like early black Pentecostalism.
Right.
But where it wasn't as politically active, but it wasn't because of accommodation. It was because there was just a huge emphasis on holiness.
Right. Right.
And they're just saying, you know what? I just want to trust Jesus and love Jesus. I know the world is sinful, but I'm not worried about that. I just want to live my life before God and raise my family. And so I think that it's possible to be like an apolitical black Christian and not be an accommodationalist. And I didn't put that category in the book, but I would say it's definitely there. And so I would say that like the black radical tradition, what I've called the revolutionary tradition, represented in someone like King or Douglas, a kind of black pietist tradition, and then like something like a black accommodationalist tradition. And what my main problem is that like in the academy, the accommodationalist and the radical tradition that gets the most air. And they both are in different ways, like not the only manifestations of black faith. And Breathing While Black was attempting to like carve out space for like another way of being a black Christian in public.
So for the sake of the listening, now I know what you mean by accommodationism, because we would have that even within the white Christian community. Talk a little bit about what accommodational Christianity sounds like and what the talking points are.
So this is like, let me talk about it this way. Let's say there's like 95% of Christian, African-American Christians say, you know, there's a significant problem with racism in our culture. The racism isn't just interpersonal, but that there are different kinds of structural disadvantages that African-Americans have experienced. And then there's like a certain, that's like 5 to 7% of the black community, maybe you put it at 10%, they go, no, racism isn't really a problem. We should just love one another. Well, that's like going to get you, you're going to be really well received in certain communities if you talk that way. It doesn't mean that they don't come to those positions honestly, right? I'm not saying that they're disingenuous. I'm saying that in so much as this acceptable to evangelical, it's accommodating in that sense to evangelical culture. Because it's not challenging them to do anything they aren't already doing. And so if you think of someone like Martin Luther King wrote a letter to the Birmingham jail, where he's pushing back on white moderates and their inability to take a strong stand against justice. Well, during the civil rights movement, all black people weren't with King.
Right.
And there were black Christians who were saying similar things to the white moderates who were saying, no, let's just follow that lead. And so I'll say an accommodationalist is someone whose theological and political stances, and I want to assume that it came to them honestly, largely mirror the talking points of the majority culture.
Which would end up being heard as white man's religion, if I'm
this is what I want to say. Like everybody got.
Well, let me clarify that, because not all whites believe that. I personally don't identify with the word evangelical.
Yeah, I'm
respectful. I really prefer the word Pentecostal.
But. Yeah. So yeah, I wasn't talking about you. I was talking about like.
No. I know you weren't. I'm saying it is a concern. It is a concern precisely because.
Yeah.
We have not wanted to critique.
Yeah.
The evangelical accommodational theology. Yeah. It's easy. It gives us a sense of we're in control.
Yeah.
Take the Bible literally. We don't wrestle with it. It's not a hermeneutics of trust at all.
So what I want to say is this, like there has to be space in every community for diversity of opinion. Sure. So I don't expect all black people to agree with me. They can be people who are more conservative and more liberal or whatever you want to say, more progressive than I am. What happens, and this is the reason why I use the language of accommodationalist. What's happened is not what goes on between these black voices themselves, right? Where a black accommodationalist and someone from the black progressive tradition or the black, you know, mainstream tradition, they're having a conversation. That's fine. we can argue about this in our community. The problem that really occurs is when those accommodationists are lifted up by white Christians and saying, right, this is what it means. This is the black person that gets it. Exactly. And this is where there tends to be hostility from the rest of the black community. We're sure. saying, we can say all of this stuff. We can get to a 95% consensus or 90% consensus. And then there are three or four black voices who are consistently weaponized against an entire consensus, right? And they, because we don't have the pulpit, we don't have the platform, these voices have a disproportionate impact. And so what I would say to people is, if you have, like, I don't know, let's just say, much love to the Quakers, right? This is not a shot at Quakers. Let's say that, like, for whatever reason, black people want to say, well, Quakers, that's white Christianity. Let's lift them up and say, this is how you do it. Well, white Christians will go, no, Quakers are one expression of Christianity, but they're not normative. And you will get tired of people every day saying, look, the Quakers finally get it, because it's not what the community decides. And the thing that makes accommodationalism so frustrating is that we don't get to decide who our leaders are. We don't get to decide who speaks for our community. And instead, we're constantly told, why don't you interact with this idea? It's like, well, hold on. This idea has been interacted with and pushed aside. But it's precisely because so many people have the power of platform that lift up these voices that on their own don't have the same standing. And so when I talk about accommodationalism, I'm talking about not saying that it's not authentically black. What I'm saying is it just does real damage when a more fringe idea is mainstreamed by people who are not a part of our community.
Yeah, and the end result is that it's still not the narrative of the black community. It is the borrowed narrative of a community that says this is what the narrative is supposed to say, and you have no right to interpret it the way
you do. I always tell people, like, we are African Americans, are one of the, especially African-American Christians, are one of the few groups who don't get to talk about the theological implications of our own narrative. Like, our narrative is picked up and used by, and redefined. I talk about it this way. You can go and look at any theology book, almost theology books written in the last 30 or 40 years, and they tell the entire history of Christian theology in the Americas. And they start from, you know, the Enlightenment, whatever, and they kind of come here. And then they say, well, in the 1960s and the 1970s, black theology is born. And they cite James Cone, who's an important scholar. I'm not talking about James Cone, but it's like black Christians were like off to the side until the 1960s. Well, no. From the moment that we received the Bible, we were engaged in the process of the biblical interpretation and making sense of it theologically. So if you start the black Christian story in the 1960s as an addendum to the real narrative,
right. That's
decentering our testimony. And whenever you do that, you start with an inevitable distortion. Imagine if you started telling the story of, like, mainline theology in the 1960s, or you started telling the story of evangelical theology in the 1960s. You'd miss it, because there's a lot of stuff that's going on. And so what I want to say is that, like, the African-American Christian tradition has value as a contribution of what it means to be Christian. And instead of that contribution being taken seriously, like, it's cannibalized and used. It's like Martin Luther King is the prime example. People say, you know, Martin Luther King says you should not, you know, judge person by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character.
Totally take it out of context.
But the same Martin Luther King says that the black man needs to reach into his soul and write his own emancipation proclamation and say that I am black and I am somebody. They don't want that strong affirmation. He said, somebody told a lie one time saying that black was everything ugly. But, like, black is beautiful. You never see the black is beautiful quote on MLK Day.
No, but he was the one that coined it.
Yes. So, and why is it that
case? And it was as controversial when I was in high school as Black Lives Matter became in this last season.
And, so, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, that's all I was. And I just want to say, like, we have the right to our own story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So when, so like, for example, we live in this, well, I mean, you got schooled at St. Andrews. I'm now at Birmingham, realizing that the English don't like the term postmodern. So post-colonial, you know, we've arrived at this place in the culture where individualism and egocentrism reigns. But most people want to go back and say, well, that started in the 60s. Well, the truth is it started four centuries before Christ with Democritus and the atomization of matter. So you can't look at the atomization of the individual without looking at the long flow of history. So when we talk about, and you bring this up in the book, when we talk about Black presence, we've got to go all the way back to Egypt and Joseph. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, what I was trying to do in that chapter, and the hard part about Bible reading, and you know this as a person who's doing his PhD, part of doing the PhD is somebody has a bad idea, and then people just uncritically all follow it. And you just, it's like people walking off the same cliff over and over again. And then you kind of go, well, hold on. Why do we all keep walking off this cliff? And PhD is just like, stop. This origin of this idea led to an entire strand of interpretation that are all wrong for this reason. Let's go back. And then once you see it, people go, oh, yeah, this is a fact hiding in plain sight. So when I talked about Black identity or African identity in the Bible, I'm not even doing like fancy exegesis as it relates to like Greek or Hebrew or Latin or German. It's just like, no, there's Africans in the Bible. Right. These Africans are brought into God's people. It's because we unconsciously adopt a narrative that erases African presence from the Bible. And people say it's never erased, but why is it never spoken about? In a world of anti-African sentiment. Some people say, well, Esau, well, like African, Egyptian isn't Black. Let me tell you something. They had the one drop rule in the South in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And so you want to say like a dark-skinned Egyptian that gets pulled over by the police in rural Mississippi was going to be able to say, well, I'm actually Egyptian. That's not going to work. And so we got this strange schizophrenia in the culture where in the culture being Black meant if you had one drip of like any African blood. But then when he went to biblical interpretation, the only people who counted as people of color were like the Ethiopians. So hold on, keep that same energy. If Black means a person of color in American segregation, then you can see how persons of color are part of God's people from the beginning. And so what I was trying to do in that chapter about Black identity is not just to say that like African Americans are part of God's plan. It was a way of saying that like God always wanted to create for himself a multi-ethnic community of people who are united under the lordship of Christ, the Messiah ultimately. And so I wanted to show that like there is no real thing. There is no real ethnically pure or biologically pure Israel. And because Israel is multi-ethnic, then there's a place for Black peoples now to say that there is not just as an addendum, but it's central to God's own purposes, a desire to create a people of which I am one particular manifestation, just like you're one particular manifestation.
So when we look at then the conversation as it is right now, where do you think the conversation needs to go when, let's say, if we can get everybody to the table?
Yeah.
Where does the conversation need to go?
I think there's a lot of things too, like as it relates to diversity that are actually super nuanced, which you can't put in a book. I think that there does need to be a continued existence of the Black church. I don't think that you want to say that like Black churches need to go away.
No, I agree.
And every church needs to be multi-ethnic. I think that like each individual like community needs to discern like what they're called to. And I think that a lot of people who might be called to have more diverse churches are simply not doing so because of the cost. Now, it's just common knowledge that oftentimes leadership development and the opportunity to pastor and grow has to happen in indigenous churches or black churches where we can kind of be the pastor and be a person in authority. And if all black people left black churches and went to integrated churches, the facts just show that we're just not chosen as leadership. And so the black church is an important leadership development pipeline where we can get a sense of self and respect and dignity and learn and grow.
Sure.
But if you're living in an increasingly multicultural, like especially in urban or even suburban areas, to have monocultural churches as the rule seems to me to like downplay what I think the gospel does. Mm-hmm. And so I would ask, like, if you're asking where the conversation needs to go, I would ask, why are there so few multi-ethnic churches in the United States? And what do we need to do to make it more multi-ethnic? And how can we, in multi-ethnic churches, support black leadership? And not just black leadership, but Asian leadership, Asian American leadership, Latino brothers and sisters. So I would say that, like, that would be where I would ask important questions. I also think that there's a lot of historic tensions that we just don't talk about. So there's like historic tensions between the African American community and the Asian American community. There's tensions in some place between the black and the Latino community. And so it's not simply a conversation between like blacks and whites, but it's a multi-directional, multi-dimensional conversation where everybody has their own like issues to deal with. I tell people, to be honest, I was raised with an implicit anti-Asian bias. I didn't know what it was, but people was like, well, look, the Asian Americans are the ones who are, you know, the beauty shops and the hair salons and the nail places. And it's like, these people are taking all of our businesses mentality. And I didn't understand like what an Asian American immigrant, a Korean, a Chinese immigrant was actually going through. So I got to college and I realized that like, I grew up in a context where I was just taught that hostility and I had to unlearn those things. And so you want to ask me like, where does the conversation go from here? It's like, well, what does it look like to really become the body of Christ that's united across difference, that still respects differences and acknowledges the places and the times where a Korean church or a Chinese church or a pan-Asian church or a black church might be necessary, and recognizing the time where we need to say, well, in this context, we really need to talk about what a multi-ethnic church ought to look like.
Yeah, in my own personal journey, I am, from the very beginning, I have been part of that which is multi-ethnic. I was raised Presbyterian in a lower middle class neighborhood in Staten Island, New York, and we were multi-ethnic. And so that's been my experience growing up. Growing up in New York, while I knew racism existed, I didn't fully comprehend the nature of the systemic realities of it fully until we got to North Carolina and we saw the effects of Jim Crow laws, and we had a congregation of people that were predominantly African American. And I mean, I got hit from both sides as a white pastor. So I wonder if your generation has more leverage, for those things because of the way you have been invited to think in a way that the baby boomer generation has not.
Yeah, I would hope so. I will say this, though, and this is something, the Pentecostal tradition of all the Christian traditions, I mean, maybe with the exception of the Catholic Church, is the one in North America that has historically been the most diverse.
Yeah.
That it's just the fact that, like, the Church of God in Christ was actually ordaining white pastors before the Assemblies of God left from their own tradition. And so there is a sense in which the Spirit has been, when we listen to the Spirit, has been able to overcome real divisions. And so I've always had respect for the Pentecostal tradition for that when I went back and began to read the history and learn about it. And so I do hope that, and I think that to my mind, Pentecostalism, or we might even say, I would say Spirit-filled Christianity has like won the day. You can call it what you want to call it, but the global church is Pentecostal. It just is. And so I think that that might mean something in our generation, that the first generation, or not even the first, second, like they fought that battle. I think that conversation is over. I don't think that like cessationism is going to win the day ever. Right. I'm not saying the United Christian is cessationist, so don't email me. I'm saying that the church is Pentecostal, or the church is charismatic, or the church is spirit, whatever language you want to use.
Sure.
And in so much as that has brought, been a harbinger of when we were being obedient to a multi-ethnic church, then I'm hopeful. I also think that one of the things, I'll talk about the Pentecostal for a minute. I feel like in this generation, in particular, one of the things that I've noticed is that the spirit-filled churches are starting to find their political and cultural voice. That for a longer time, they were much more separated from these direct issues of social action. And I think that if we get a spirit-filled, socially active, multi-ethnic church, then we might finally begin to look like what I think the early church looked like, or at least the early church is depicted in the New Testament.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, in the book, you talk about Luke Acts as the entry point for the conversation. You do know that Pentecostals also claim our entrance into the canon is Luke Acts. I thought that was brilliant. It was a brilliant turn theologically, and it just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so what Luke is attempting to do is articulate the place of the Gentiles in God's wider purposes. And if Luke, as a Gentile, writing to other Gentiles, saying that their inclusion is not some U-turn in history, but is a manifestation of God's own plan, then I call him the patron saint of African-American interpreters, who had to say to Black Christians that, you know, the Black conversion, despite what the white slave master said to you, was not some innovation in history, but God's own plan. The other thing to make Luke's gospel, Luke and Acts so important, is that Luke's writing to Theophilus. And he said, there's a lot of Jesus that's been presented, but I want to make sure you get the true Jesus. And in so much as the African-American pastor or the person who pastors African-Americans are trying to say the distortions of Jesus that you might have heard in the popular culture are incorrect. But the God of the Bible, the Jesus who we see in Luke, is the God worthy for our trust. Then he also points to like the same exegetical work. And one of the things that you see when you read these early slave testimonies is this idea that they themselves are seeing their conversion as a manifestation of God's saving plan in the fullness of time. And so I call Luke the patron saint of Black interpreters. Him and Frederick Douglass are like my two kind of hermeneutical guides.
Profound. It's just profound. And then
I'm glad you asked about that though, Mark, because my favorite, like the part of the book that I had the most fun writing was reading while Black, that chapter on justice, and in particular the first section on Luke. And my son's name is Luke, so you can kind of see the bias. But yeah, that section was my favorite part of the book to write. And the most creative, and to my mind, the most creative and the most theological.
So let's talk a little about just personal life for a moment, if that's okay. And you know, the book is Reading While Black, and obviously we all know Driving While Black is a profound statement. I pastor here in Orlando. We've been here 20 some odd years. Matthew was 8 years old when we moved here. I just had my fourth grandson 2 days ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But what Matthew has played the drums for me since he was 7 years old. Donnie Harper was my worship leader from New Jersey Mass Choir when we were in Raleigh, when he took a break from Newark, because he worked with Sissy and Whitney for all his life. And he took a break and he helped us down there. He saw Matthew's potential, put him on the drums right away. And Matthew has been our drummer, plus he's on staff. One night they were driving home from church, you know, and my daughter-in-law and the three kids are in the back seat, and a young cop pulls him over, and Nasty gets him out of the car and says, "Where's the drugs?" Now, he pulled him over supposedly for a left taillight something or other, or my daughter-in-law's, he must have checked because there was a pending thing on her registration. And he took my son through a horrific, horrific encounter. And it's not the only one he's had. But in the book, you talk about your own encounter. Yeah. Talk to me about, because I had the conversation as a white man with a young black son growing up. But talk to me as an African-American leader, pastor, priest, growing a family. You've got four children. Talk to me about how you converse with them at this season, even though we should be way past this, because this has to do with police reform and everything else. Just share your heart.
I try to tell my children that the police don't always see your CV when they pull you over. And this is the part that's dangerous, right? They're like, I'm not a priest who's written two books when I'm pulled over by the police.
Right.
And I have certain children who are very strong-willed. In a good way, I have a keen sense of justice. And, you know, explain to me why it's wrong. And I've had to say to them, well, listen, we can fight, we can deal with any problem once you get back home. But I can't help you if you don't get home. Yeah. And so I say to him, I say to my son, I talk about what happens when you move from being cute to dangerous as a black boy. And I say to my son, listen, you're going to experience something most likely. Or you may even see your white friends who you're with who are going to be treated differently. They're going to fill you with anger. And you're going to want to do A, B, and C. But I said, listen, you make it your goal in that moment to do whatever it takes to get back home. And once you get back home, we'll deal with it. And it's a hard thing to say because I talk about in the book, the rage.
Right. And yeah,
anger, the frustration that builds in the hearts and minds of African American Christians who have to deal with this. But yeah, like I've had to swallow my pride so that I might live as a black man in America. And so I try to instruct my children as best I can about that. I tell people I have a bias towards joy. Well, as it relates to raising my children, I don't tell them about every single thing that happens on the news, because like life and being black in America is gonna come. Like I don't need to give them that early. That's gonna come to them. But the chance for them to be children and to have uncomplicated joy is so rare. And so I try to, as a father, try to balance between keeping my children aware of the world in which they live, but give them a chance to be kids. Because one of the things that you talked about, at 8 years old, my childhood came to an end.
It did.
And I don't want to prematurely end that. And so my kids they're not naive, but they're much more innocent than I was as a kid, because they didn't grow up in the Jim Crow South in part, but they still understand and they still experience things and we still talk about it. But I try to balance keeping them aware with giving them a chance to be 6-year-old, 8-year-old, 10-year-old, 12-year-olds.
Okay, last question. And I thank you for your transparency. If you put your prophetic eyeglasses on and telescope out 10, 20 years, 30 years, tell me what you see and what you sense. You will be alive. I can tell you, you will be one of the formidable voices in theology and in the black community for the sake of where God wants to take the church. That I have no doubt about. But what do you see happening in the next 20 to 30 years?
I think that, let me talk about a couple of different communities.
Okay.
I think in the largely white churches, there's a coming kind of second divide between like evangelicalism as a loose coalition of people. But I think there's going to be a much stronger and clearer divide between the anti-justice evangelical tradition and the evangelicals who care about justice. I think that I think the Pentecostalism is continuing to grow and mature. And I hope that this is not paternalistic, but the coming of age theologically and politically, and that'll be a future 10 or 15 years from now. I think in the African-American context, there is an increasing tension that I think is going to come out much more in the open. That right now, the Black church has not really experienced any the public and lasting divisions that have marked kind of white Christianity. I think that there's theological differences within the broader Black church that'll become more and more evident over time. Yeah. And that though we will cooperate on issues of injustice, I think that the theological distinctions within the Black church will become more evident, or within the Black Christian tradition more broadly, more evident. And I'm not sure, the implications of that. I know I've had so many Black pastors ask me the same question of saying, well, we don't know where to send our people to seminary. Wow. Because we go to one community and we have some political agreements, but theological disagreements. In place where there's surface theological disagreements, the culture and the hesitancy around issues of injustice is so prominent. And so I think that that frustration is going to peak. So I think that what you would see, if there is a future for the American church, the future leadership of the American church will be multi-ethnic. That we will no longer have a church where it's just the white guys are doing all of the theology and everybody else is following along. I think the credibility in our culture is going to have to be a multi-ethnic coalition of white, Black, Asian, Latina Christians who are committed to the great tradition, who are pushing back upon an increasingly secular world with the good news of Jesus Christ. So I guess if you want to say, not that the future of the church is multi-ethnic and that every church will be multi-ethnic, but I think that the leadership and the people who speak about and for Christianity in America is going to be multi-ethnic if it's going to be viable. I just don't think that our culture is going to listen to a monocultural church. And I don't even think that the white portions of our church, of American society, are going to listen to a monocultural church. So the greatest hope for the future of Christianity, at least this Christianity that's favorable to the great tradition, is a Christianity that is united across ethnic difference, that platforms leaders of color.
Wonderful. I you remind me of Rowan Williams when you talk like that. And Rowan is, I happen to just love Rowan, but I mean, the fact that he says we need to stay at the table and keep talking. And Esau, it has been an honor to all of you that are listening to the podcast. We've been just having a wonderful time conversing. Esau McCauley is a PhD. He graduated from St. Andrews, where he studied under the work of N.T. Wright. He writes for the New York Times. He writes for the Washington Post and others. His brand new book, Reading While Black, African American Biblical Interpretation as an Exercise in Hope, is available from InterVarsity Press. You can get it on Amazon. His website, esaumccauley.com, is worth perusing. And Esau, thank you for your time. It has been invaluable, and I deeply appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Invite me back, and I would love to, post-pandemic, maybe even actually worship together with your congregation.